Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova.
So we've got Joe Brewer here for another Q&A. This is the second one only that we've done, right?
Third.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. John Verbeke, Nora Bateson, right. So if you guys haven't listened to the Joe Brewer podcast that we did, you should go check that out. Maybe someone can find the link for that and post it in the chat. That'd be great.
Yeah, Nev, could you drop a link?
Cool. So how do we want to start this? Does anyone have questions that they want to start, or should Yuvi and I do our thing? This is a very kind of casual format. We can just take it as it goes here.
Yeah, so maybe a little bit of an introduction if you guys don't know. Joe Brewer has been doing a lot of work with regenerative cultures, and he's been traveling all around the world studying different practices that communities are engaging in to regenerate their environment, their social communities, their families. It's a very holistic approach. So we're actually really excited to have him back. We interviewed him on the podcast a little while ago, and we wanted to follow up with how his work has been going. And we just did a pre-chat before the stream went live, and there's some really, really interesting stuff that we'd love to talk about. So yeah, if you guys have questions, feel free to pop them in the YouTube chat, and we'll pick the best ones and have them answered. So yeah, we can start. If Carol or Ari have a question that they'd like to start with, you can go. Otherwise, I have a million questions, so I can start as well.
All right,
I haven't got any questions yet.
Okay, cool.
Okay, sure. Well, we can start with let's do an update on what you've been doing. For example, the conversation that you just told us about before we started this call that you were having with a bunch of other parents about co-creating an environment, a community environment that promotes healthy education for children and also creates a community around it and also is good for the environment.
Yeah, this is something that is really profound and obvious once it's stated, and yet a lot of people don't seem to share it in discussions of social change strategies. And the thing is that the pathway to transform a culture needs to be something that an entire family can walk. So if you're going to try to change a culture by making it possible for someone to have a certain kind of job or to be able to live in one place or another place, like after I graduated from college, I went to this city for my job or that one. That normally the way that people's lives are structured and scaffolded is around individuals, or it's around the adults, but not the kids. And so this fragmentation that happens in families between parents and their children is a really serious issue. Probably the most dramatic version of this is when parents send their kids to daycare so they can go back to work. And then often that means that the second parent has to have a full-time job to pay for the daycare. So basically you're both working full-time to not have any family connection. And this breakdown in family is a huge deal. And what we're working on in a really practical way, my wife and I with our three-year-old daughter, is we're working on how to evolve a life system, a way of living our entire, you know, every aspect of our lives, where raising our children can be central and our livelihoods and what you might call our economic activities, the things that we do that create value for ourselves and others and that provide sustenance for us, that these things all become integrated with each other. And so we have been in Colombia now for about 3 months in the village of Barichara, which has about 5,000 people. It's in the mountains in the northern Andes. And it's a place that's been heavily deforested and has really serious challenges with water and ecological collapse, but also is a place with deep and rich cultural knowledge about things like earthen construction using clay, indigenous ways of making baskets and textiles from natural fibers, and other things that are part of historical or ancestral life systems that are still present in the culture of the place. So what we're doing with these other families is exploring how could we homeschool together instead of homeschooling alone. So there are children that are ranging in age from the youngest is just under 2 years old and the oldest is almost 7. And there are 5 children in total between these 3 families. How can we raise our children together while increasingly bringing our livelihoods and our passions as adults into the ways that we do regenerative work and using pedagogical insight to see that the way we do our work informs the education of our children? And so that's something we've been doing, and it's been really a powerful experience so far, learning as we go, because it's very much a pattern of emergence.
It's amazing that we've been conditioned to think that raising children is the job of the nuclear family. In the West, that seems to be a prevalent thinking on the subject, and there's something really wrong with that. And I really love that you're exploring this child-centric community, family-centric community, where it's everybody's involved and children get exposed to different ideas from different adults. They can get exposed to different skills that different people can teach them. It's just, it seems a much healthier approach. And they also get to develop relationships with people who care about them and support them, not just the parents.
Yeah, like I was reading a really nice anthropology paper today studying 2 hunter-gatherer groups in East Africa that are spread across Tanzania and Kenya. And what they were looking at was how much learning, or really how much teaching, is done from parent to child, as contrasted with the amount of teaching that is done child to child at different ages. And what they found by doing minute-to-minute ethnography, so every minute you make an observation related to the thing you're studying, that they found about 75% of the teaching was older children teaching younger children. And only 25% of the time was direct instruction from adults to children. So this pattern of having an integrated community where there are multiple ages and all, you know, the different genders and sexes of children together embedded within a community context with adults, that the kids are imitating the adults, but they're being taught mostly by older kids. And so this way of seeing how that is done, that that's sort of an ancestral model of education that goes back hundreds of thousands of years, at least at the Homo sapiens in our modern anatomical form, really says something about what's wrong with having kids divided by age, sitting in lines and rows in a classroom with an adult giving them information, as opposed to actually trying to construct the tools. Like if the adults use spears to go to the river to get the fish, then the kids are trying to make spears as they just pick up sticks that look spear-like. And the kids that are pretty bad at it, of course, because it's hard and technical, but the older kids are better at it, so they've had more time to do it, so they instruct the younger kids. This shouldn't be surprising at all. All of us who have siblings, you know, older brothers and younger brothers, younger older sisters and younger sisters, will relate to this is something we did in our lives as kids. But it's just such a profound remembering how natural that is.
And this, the idea of having things integrated is so central here, I think, because the way that children are raised now, they're sitting in a classroom isolated from the world, from the real world. For example, I remember when I went to school and then I graduated high school and I went out into the real world, I had kind of a culture shock. Because it was completely different. People responded to me differently, you know, things functioned differently. I was just completely unprepared. But the way that you're describing it, it seems that children are integrated into the real world in a very kind of seamless way. They're just there and they're learning on the go.
Yeah, this also relates to a larger maybe like a pattern of emergence that is happening around the world. And it's sort of an untold story, which is the story of all of the people who, tuned out and dropped out back in the 60s and 70s, that back to the land movement that happened, which later evolved into what today is thousands of permaculture projects around the world. There are thousands and thousands of permaculture projects around the world. And what you see, if you go to the places where the permaculture retreat center or agroforestry farm or whatever it is, if the people running it had kids, that their kids get integrated into this indigenous model of education, almost by practical necessity. It's like, well, you're homeschooling your kid because, you know, they're out in the garden with you, or you're taking them with you when you're teaching and living, building, construction project, or whatever it may be. And so there's this kind of movement of like a mycelial network of thousands and thousands of regenerative cultural seeds that, if they have children present, the children must be integrated into their life system in this way for practical reasons. And that eventually, if it breaks down, it's because they don't have enough capacity to really focus on educating the kids, and the kids end up going to a public school, which you see in some eco-villages, for example, where they don't quite manage to do this. But what we're seeing is that by focusing on it, it gives us a really specific design element, which is the design element of pacing ourselves. We have so many things happening at exponential scales around the world, but our kids grow at the rate that kids grow. And so we pace ourselves around the needs of our children. Our daughter is now 3 years old. She needs lots of social interaction. So we're seeking out other families with other kids that are not exactly the same age, but are in a range of ages overlapping with hers. And the pace of her learning and her development is helping us make life decisions. It anchors a lot of what we're doing in ways that we wouldn't know how to do otherwise. And so it's that pacing element is, it's really, you sort of see it when you look backward and notice how much it shaped your decisions, more than it being conscious most of the time. But for us, as we're consciously trying to do it, we're finding it to be a very powerful design, like a generative design perspective, because we don't do things that are inappropriate to our child's development. It's pretty obvious it doesn't work when we try it. And then we see also that what is working is flourishing, because kids are so dramatically different when they're flourishing. See their curiosity, their inquisitiveness, their self-confidence, and just, you know, lots of things that come when kids are thriving. And so these elements of the indicators, I should say, of the pacing of development tell us that we're either doing it right or not, and give us immediate feedback moment by moment.
What I find really interesting about this is how practical the experience is for you and for the kids teaching the kids. There's almost this built-in kind of rite of passage in that you as a child, once you've learned something, are now responsible to pass this on to the people behind you. And I can see how this kind of over-compartmentalization of how we've built Western society has contributed to this problem of not having people not feeling like they have any responsibility, not going through this transition into adulthood or stages of adulthood. Like when I think back about to my experience of elementary school in Canada, like one of the few things that stood out was the one time out of my whole experience here that they paired us up with the older kids to help them, to get them to teach us how to learn or how to read, sorry. And it was a really interesting experience to be on both sides of that. And it's one of the few things that stood out to me about that experience, because it felt like such a responsibility to give someone else a good experience similar to what I was given.
Yeah. There's another piece of this that is what is happening for us in Bodhichara. We came here because there's a family with three children, and this family is part of the homeschooling group. And they have a forest school that they've started, Escuela del Bosque, and which is just a Spanish for school, for forest school. And what they're doing is offering a part-time educational experience. That's 3-hour sessions a couple of days a week. And they've built it around the normal structuring of the family's lives. And it's in a community-owned food forest that's being developed by some elder women in the community. That's about 10 years old, this food forest. And what's interesting is that when you watch the kids playing in the forest, one thing that you get really comfortable with, or you take your kid out, is you get comfortable with kids just doing things unstructured and partially unsupervised. Because if you have 10 kids that are in the forest near each other, they're going to run off in different directions. And, you know, you'll have moments where they sort of can be brought into shared focus. Like when the person who sits down with a drum and starts singing a song and all the kids come into a circle, but then they get excited and energized by the music and some of them run off. And, you know, they're all within visible range, but you're not really overseeing everything that they're doing. And, you know, some kids are climbing rocks and some kids are trying to climb trees and others are like we learned how to take, it's clay rock here. So you can take rocks and bang them together and they become a powder. And then if you pour water on it, it becomes clay and you can mold clay artifacts. So you can do like homemade ceramics in about 5 minutes just by playing in the dirt. So all these interesting ways that we see the kids just playing in a semi-unstructured way. And then we have activities that give them almost like creative inspiration, like showing them that they can bang the rocks to make powder and put water on it and then they paint. And that means my daughter, when I take her to the Bioparque, this community park, when we're walking through, she wants to take out her water bottle from our backpack, pour it on the ground and start painting because she knows that the clay forms a natural paint. And so the kids are just inspired to be creative by little moments of directed instruction, but they really explore it through unstructured exploration and play. And that's where they're teaching each other. That's where the older kids and the younger kids are interacting. And the kids do group into different ages naturally at times. It's not that they're always doing cross-age interaction. It's just that it's very organic how it flows.
You mentioned I'll just be quick with this one. You mentioned the mycelial network of people in the 60s going out there and starting these communities. I'm wondering if after having been involved in it for a while now, you've noticed any of the connections between them or any kind of meta structure coming up.
Yeah, the meta structure I've noticed is isolation, fragmentation, and slow decline to decay. Just basically, most of these projects have very difficult time being self-sustaining. And so a lot of them have sort of run themselves out. And the more intentional community-oriented ones, most of them had failed because of what we've talked about before, the lack of internal social development for capacity to be in community. A common cause for intentional communities to break down is rampant cheating among the founding families. So-and-so is sleeping with someone else's partner and eventually, you know, that sort of stuff that happens when you're dealing with real humans who aren't mature enough and capable enough to be responsible and communicate and handle their conflicts. And so so a lot of the more intentional community, eco-village types of things, a lot of them have failed. But the other really like large-scale pattern I would describe is that there has been a war of attrition that's been run by the globalized system to keep these things from spreading. So most people disengage to a large extent from the larger economic system and then just try to survive as long as they can. And if they come upon a business model that works, that business model comes to be an organizing principle and limits what they can do. So maybe they become a teaching facility that offers permaculture design courses, which means all they're doing is cycling people through beginner's projects, but they're not doing larger scale integrative work. And so the pattern level that I see, I would describe in evolutionary terms as some symbiosis, a little bit of synergy, but not enough, and the inadequate conditions for an evolutionary transition. And an evolutionary transition is specifically when you achieve the integration of functions so that the interdependence becomes life-preserving. What that means is to stop interacting means to die. Like the mitochondria in your cell cannot live as a free-form bacteria any longer. It is functionally interdependent with the eukaryotic cell. Evolutionary transitions have this functional interdependence that occurs. And if you look around at permaculture projects, you'll see they're all isolated projects. And they very rarely achieve symbiosis, and I don't know that I'd say none, but mostly very, very few examples, if they exist, that achieve interdependence, which is this evolutionary transition that's needed.
Have you seen any of them recognize the need for this interdependence and interconnectivity? And is anybody actually working to mitigate this?
Yes, some of them see it. Some of them would be aware of it, but they would say it's not their their problem to work on. The reason is they're too busy dealing with everything else. And they know that what they're doing is valuable, so they really are sticking to their mission, which is good for them to do. What I've often seen when people are trying to do the larger scale work is that it's unfunded, unrecognized, and unappreciated. These are the network weavers, the people who weave ecosystems of human relationships. They usually do this work for years without anyone really understanding what they're doing. And the places where I see it work comes because of some higher level institutional support. Like there's a development fiasco where a dam breaks down in Brazil and the United Nations comes in with a set of programs to bring in $10 million in funding to do a development project. And you happen to have a team of people that are good at facilitating multi-stakeholder networks. So there are situations like this that emerge, but they don't arise from the regenerative projects themselves. The ones that have been successful so far have an infusion of outside support. They still work in a bottom-up fashion, but that outside support is essential. And I would think of this as like how the birth canal is important for supporting the birth of a baby. That the baby is doing all of its own thing to develop and make its way out, but without that thing that's external to the baby as an organism, that external support, which is the mother's body, without that kind of support to guide it through the fragile development process, they usually don't work. And so you could see that with large scale, you know, restoration projects, conservation management projects. But probably the best examples that do work are things like sustainable fisheries. They overfished the fishery, it collapsed, but then they formed a multi-stakeholder collaboration and found a way to manage it in a collective manner. But it's a multi-year process and they have people who become a sort of like professional facilitator or institutional actors that maintain the support of quality facilitation. And a lot of these regenerative projects don't have that, which is why I call it a war of attrition, because where is all the money and support to do that? Well, look at the tax havens, look at the 1,400 billionaires, look at how six families have half the world's private wealth, and et cetera, et cetera. You'll see why these projects are not able to get the resources they need. All those resources have been stolen by the cancer logic of a different economic system. And so this is where the composting dimension comes in. When that dominant system begins to really self-terminate and break down, it's going to release a lot of resources. But that releasing process is going to be devastating and traumatic for a lot of people. But I feel like we're probably too late to avoid that by several decades now. So that's just part of what this preparation process is helping people to be stabilizers in transitions that are going to be very unpleasant to enable these projects to scale in a mycelial way of higher level functional integration.
Somebody in the chat says that they feel that in less developed countries, this really seems closer. Do you think that's the case?
That's my experience, yes. I've seen the two places where this kind of regenerative development, where it really has worked well. I'll give three examples, actually. One is the indigenous communities that have managed to remain mostly intact. It's like the Kogi people of the Santa Marta Mountains and the Northern Andes. As an example, they've mostly remained isolated enough and they've remained a relatively intact indigenous culture. So in places that are almost entirely separated from the development as usual model or like this, they sort of never stopped being like this. The other place would be like Detroit, places where they've experienced economic collapse. And in the aftermath of economic collapse, there's a renaissance that occurs, an unleashing that comes through the death and decay, which is actually a process of ecological succession, of how ecosystems go through stages of development that cycle the nutrients of the previous life. So that's the second. And the third is these places that we call, I'm using my fingers, underdeveloped, because of course, you know, I have a lot of problems with the framing of development in economics. But these so-called underdeveloped places are actually places that are less entrenched in destructive systems. And people live more of a subsistence way of life. And one of my meditations in the last 2 years has been to recognize that subsistence is not a negative word. It's actually a description of sustainable cultures. So we say people do subsistence farming. What we mean is they have a sustainable livelihood. But what in the mainstream economic discourse is they're in subsistence. We need to save them because their lives suck. They're not developed enough. And so this is an issue of developmental entrenchment, because the structures that get developed constrain choices and cycle and direct the flows of things. So in a lot of places that are, in this case, overdeveloped in the wrong way, it's very difficult to cultivate these regenerative capacities. And so we have to regenerate from those entrenched structures, which is harder. So I think that question is spot on at having that insight and probably some knowledge about these patterns.
I have a question. You talked about regenerative culture as raising kids together. And is this everything it does entail? Or is this something more?
There's a much bigger conversation that we can have about what regenerative cultures are. And I'll give one way to expand it, and then we can see where we go from there. One way to expand it is to recognize that regeneration is the self-generating process of any living system. So when we talk about the word or the concept of regeneration, we're talking about a living entity's ability to reproduce its conditions of being alive. A very concrete example is how every 30 days, all the cells in your skin die and are replaced by other cells that are forming. It's continual regeneration as a dynamic process. And the technical term for that is autopoiesis. But when we think of what is regenerative and then ask what about human cultures are regenerative, what we can see is life-destroying cultures have regenerative aspects to them. And this is just a nuance that doesn't normally get talked about in regenerative design. But if you look at the boom-bust cycle of a virus, like a viral outbreak, you have this exponential growth of a virus or an epidemic of some kind of disease, and it's able to enter into an environment. A single-celled organism enters an environment where there's an abundance of resources, so it grows very quickly. Then it goes through an overshoot and collapse pattern. There's a lot of regeneration in that pattern, meaning it is a living system functioning regeneratively the entire time, but it's also a self-terminating pattern because it's inherently unstable. And I only say that because as we go into discussing how to create regenerative human cultures, one of our challenges is to refrain from having ethical judgments about cultures as good or bad, and instead try to see from a living systems lens what is regenerative and what is not regenerative in a specific culture. Because then we can start to see places of growing the regenerative aspects to become more encompassing within that culture. And I think raising of children is an example of this, where if we try to raise children in a more regenerative way, then we go to a more whole systems perspective and a more integrative point of view. But another way of looking at this would be what people do with life cycle analysis of products, where they look at what are all the material inputs for creating a product, when the product is created, what's the role of packaging and transport and all the different aspects of getting it to its marketplace, and then eventually it's used, and eventually it breaks down and is recycled, or it's thrown away and put in a landfill, and you have this life cycle of the product. Another way to get into regenerative culture is to see which aspects of those engineering or industrial activities are working with the ecosystems that they come from and which ones aren't. And this isn't about raising children, but it's just another lens in. And we could go on to other places in culture and in human systems to see where regenerative aspects can be brought more to life. What I find powerful about raising children is that our planetary scale challenges are so large that they unfold on larger timescales than a human generation. And so this intergenerational component is more important than it is in something like product design, product design, it's the life cycle of the product that matters, and looking at generations of development use and recycling or reuse of those products. But in human systems, you know, this is captured by that saying from Confucius that, you know, if you're thinking in terms of a year, plant rice. If you're thinking in terms of a decade, plant a tree. If you're thinking in terms of a century, raise a child. That this is just a way of thinking. And the child raising has that larger scale focus. I don't know if that gets at your question well enough, because I sort of wanted to lay groundwork around the conversation, but we can dive back into something specific if that's helpful.
You asked me a question, right?
And I was just curious if that did answer your question, or was, because I was trying to be more like laying context, and I don't know if I answered the question adequately.
You explained it to me, but still I don't necessarily see a difference between a regenerative culture from Brazil than from my culture from Poland, and whether my culture is regenerative or not.
Yeah, okay, I see. Well, one thing that's really a powerful frame, like a mental frame for making sense of regenerative cultures, when our goal is sustainability. So like, just like this, the skin cells in your body reproduce themselves every 30 days, you have sustainability as long as your body is alive. So sustainability is a byproduct of processes of regeneration.
I see.
And so regenerative cultures have a byproduct of being sustainable.
So for example, a regenerative culture that cares about environment is sustainable because it doesn't destroy itself.
Yeah, it keeps the cycles of regenerativity going. So whatever inputs are needed to be alive are not depleted, and they continually become available again. One way to think about this that I think is pretty powerful is to look at cross-cultural anthropology research and see which societies have become stable for long periods of time and which societies become unstable and then lead to collapse. And what we found is every empire and civilization in history has a pattern of instability and a pattern of overshoot and collapse. But also all empires and civilizations have occurred during what geologists call the Holocene, a 10,000 year period of warm, stable climate after the last ice age. And when we look at all of the stable cultures, what becomes really powerful is the regulating mechanism of religion. And Edward Goldsmith is the person who I think has most powerfully synthesized this perspective with cross-cultural anthropology. What he looked at was, in different kinds of indigenous cultures, which ones become stable over time? And what are the cultural traits of those societies that enable them to become stable over time? And what he found was summarized by another person, Michael Dowd, as pro-future social norms. Social norms that actually care about and act on the future in a normative way. And when Edward Goldsmith talked about this, he saw it through two key aspects. One is personifying ecological relationships. So the river is not an object, the river is a person. The tree is not an object, the tree is a person. The rock is not an object, the rock is a person. So this personifying of ecological relationships, together with treating those relationships as sacred, so that children would be raised in a kind of spiritual ethic of caring about the river because the river is a person, caring about the tree because the tree is a person. And there would be stories and rituals and ceremonies and various kinds of social norm reinforcement that their religion would do for them through mythic narratives and personified relationships. And what's interesting about this is that if you look at the writing of more contemporary thinkers like Wendell Berry, where he describes that one of the biggest problems that we have in the modern world is a kind of environmental autism, which is that we've lost the ability to enter into a relationship of I, thou with the rest of the natural world. And when we lose that ability, we lose the feedbacks, the social and ecological feedbacks within our cultures to be able to manage relationships for the future. And so I think of this as a really powerful way to design for regenerative culture. You could look at it through a purely scientific lens and say, what are the functions of the ecosystems that we depend upon for our survival? How do we need to manage them? And then go back and ask, how do humans manage these things? Well, through stories, through morality tales, through raising of children, through moment-to-moment normative behaviors. And so there's this powerful way of merging the science and religion aspects around this for the design of regenerative cultures. And it's sort of a diagnostic tool as well. If we see a culture that does not treat ecological relationships in a responsible way, then instead of being pro-future, it's inherently anti-future, which means in the long run, it's going to undermine its ecological efficacy and eventually collapse. And so that's one way of looking at cultures and their regenerative aspects that I think is really deep and profound and has lots of applications and implications for how we do the work.
Okay.
Hey everyone, just a reminder that for $5 a month, you'll get access to all of our full podcast episodes, unreleased material from past episodes, and occasional extra content from our courses, including guided meditations, lessons, and more. Plus, you'll be helping us keep the lights on.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
Is there a way to apply these regenerative culture principles like to big cities? To me, it seems like big cities are doomed if you look this stream of development that is current right now. But is there a way, like, I mean, are necessarily big cities like megalopolis in Asia, in big countries, are they necessarily doomed?
I wouldn't say they're necessarily doomed, but I've come to a conclusion very grudgingly because I didn't like the conclusion. But I've come to the conclusion that first, there's sort of a philosophical point. We have no reason, we have no evidential basis to believe that cities will exist in the future because the only evidence we have of them in the past was during the Holocene, and the Holocene is now over. And so we don't actually know if they can exist in the future, which is a really disturbing philosophical insight. And more philosophical than really science, it's sort of scientific, but it's an inductive inference. So it's not necessarily valid. It's more like a concern to be aware of that we just need to practice discernment around. But the other thing that I've seen that's more thermodynamic, and so I think it's got stronger implications about the future of cities, is that there is a pattern of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, that you can see in cities in two ways. One way you see it is through the work of people like Jeffrey West with what he calls allometric scaling. You can see that cities actually become more resilient and robust as internal cultural systems the larger their populations become and the more dense they become. They actually increase their learning, collective learning capacities as the populations grow. That seems to imply that cities are actually resilient, except for the other thermodynamic element, which is that cities do this by degrading increasingly large surface areas of landscapes in their surrounding environments. And that larger pattern is the pattern of eventual collapse of civilizations. And so what I draw from this, looking at the work of people like Joseph Tainter, as an archaeologist that studies civilization collapse, I've come to the conclusion that cities are unlikely to exist in the future. Or if they exist, there'll be a lot fewer of them, and they will be structured differently than they are now. Although some things will be the same. They'd still be near large rivers and other aspects that cities depend upon. But the future of cities, to me, is, I think there's a lot of accidental hubris where people project normalcy onto cities when they don't realize how abnormal this period of history is. And so if we're really going to be discerning as critical thinkers, we have to go down that rabbit hole, even though it's a disturbing one to go down. And then from there, do the best design work that we can. And so I'm hedging on all of this because I don't want to pretend to know the answer, but I have, yeah, like a fairly strong analysis that's compelling for me that cities are unlikely to exist in the future or unlikely to exist in large numbers. And that, so you see, I'm holding it with that uncertainty on purpose because I actually don't know. But that's where I sit with my perspective.
You're saying that cities will not probably exist in the future, but you assume that, for example, there will not be overpopulation, that the landmass of the earth won't decrease because of the increase of water, and still humanity can die by many reasons, and it's very hard for me to believe in any particular version of the future.
Yeah, you know, the book that I found most powerful for clarifying my understanding of these issues is a book written by William Catton Jr. It's called Overshoot. It was published in 1977. And he was a human ecologist who taught in a sociology department at the time. And what he did that was different from what most people do who study these large patterns is he introduced key ecological concepts and then fully applied them to humans. He removed the exceptionalism of humans, this presumed exceptionalism, and just treated us like any other organism in an ecosystem. When he did this, he combined some really powerful concepts that were not his concepts, but he employed them in a very powerful way. One of them is the concept of ghost acreage. Ghost acreage is if you take a geographically bounded area, like let's take the lower 48 United States, or you take the Eurozone of Europe or any other geographically bounded area, and you look at how many people live there and ask, where do they get their food? And then you measure how many acres of land do they grow food on within that geographic area? And ghost acreage is all of the land area outside of that bounded area that they depend upon for growing their food. And there's an equivalent of this with a sort of ghost acreage for marine ecosystems, for fishing. And so there are some interesting nuances and complexity. But what's powerful about using concepts like this is that our geographic boundaries that have become metaphysically primary, like the United States is an ontological entity. This sort of thinking that has happened with nation states, you can go under that and look at the whole systems with this ecological lens. And what he found was that there were two ways that human population was already overshot. You know, we exceeded our planetary carrying capacity, and it happened before any of us were born. And one question you then have to answer is, if it's a carrying capacity, how is it possible to go beyond it? So he needed to introduce a concept of temporary carrying capacity. And he did this by showing that there were two major frontiers that enabled this overshoot to happen, where a mythology of progress could be maintained. And his name for this mythology was the Age of Exuberance. The Age of Exuberance is captured by things like the philosophy of manifest destiny and the idea of infinite GDP growth and the things that we see today among economists. And the Age of Exuberance is important because it's connected to one of the frontiers. So one of the frontiers that he named was that there was a specific period of increasing population density in Europe where they were starting to experience some overshoot patterns. But by several accidents of history, they discovered a mostly empty set of continents, the Americas, because a set of plagues and diseases killed off most of the people on them due to European contact. And so when a lot of Europeans arrived in the Americas, it was like finding another hemisphere of empty earth. That was the ghost acres that they could develop upon. And because of the period of expansion that grew from this over about 150 years, people could believe that nature was infinitely abundant, and they could believe that human ingenuity could solve all problems. And it created he actually coined the phrase cargo cult in his book Overshoot. And cargo cults are people who are techno-optimists who are born within this period of the Age of Exuberance and believe that human ingenuity can solve all problems. So that was one element, was the human population could grow within a cultural mythology of progress that was able to be blind to its ecological consequences for that period of expansion. Then the second frontier that allowed temporary overshoot was the discovery and use of fossil fuels, which was basically the capturing of photosynthesis over a span of 200 million years that we will have depleted within about 300 years. So it's six orders of magnitude difference, like a million times faster than it was generated is how quickly we're depleting it. And so what happened with fossil fuels was this age of exuberance, which had created a cultural mythology of infinite progress, was able to continue fueling itself, overshooting the population even further, even faster. And so now we're in a position that we've already overshot the human population. It happened before any of us on this call were born. And it's we can all be blind to it because of these large-scale systemic patterns. We have to unlearn some things to be able to see it. So then what gets really interesting is to ask, what happens after the overshoot corrects itself, meaning that the human population goes down? And in his book, he had a graph with four images that were different concepts for carrying capacity, where the first three were false and the fourth one was correct. Each one was adding another nuance to say, well, here's the first one, but it's wrong. Let's add another piece. Here's the second one. It's better, but it's also wrong because it didn't add this third piece. Here's the third one, which is also wrong because we didn't add the fourth piece. And then you get to the image. And what you have is there's a temporary carrying capacity and there's a real carrying capacity, and they're different. And the temporary carrying capacity is influenced by the social organization of the human culture, its technological capabilities, and the condition of the environment that it happens to be in at the time. And those are interacting dynamics, allowing the felt experience of carrying capacity to be dynamic. So anyone who believes there's a static carrying capacity is misunderstanding this dynamic component. But another piece is you can have a temporary carrying capacity that dramatically exceeds the real carrying capacity. And that means as the population grows, you degrade the environment, which reduces the temporary carrying capacity, but you're still over the real one, which means that your ability to adapt to the lower one as you're about to return to it, you actually lose some of that ability during that period of time. And then what happens is the collapse actually goes below the real carrying capacity, which is whatever the renewable ecological, you know, what some people call ecosystem services today, the actual renewable patterns of the biosphere that could hold the population, which of course is dependent on social organization and technology. So it's still not a static number, but at least it's in within some realistic range of those throughputs, that you actually can drop the population below that level. And that's where extinction events occur. Is if you go too low, you create an extinction event. But if you don't create an extinction event, then you either rid yourself of the hubris of false progress and return to real sustainability, or you start another cycle, which will only further degrade the environment until eventually the human system ends, basically they go extinct. And so there's this really complex set of dynamics that are involved. And most people don't even learn carrying capacity in a static sense, let alone in this dynamic sense. And this is why I think William Catton's book is so important, is he just explains it very clearly. And if you look at his examples from the late 1970s, it's very prescient. You can see him describing a lot of the things that are visibly evident today that were not on the radar of people back then. So that's a bit of a longer digression into that topic, but I think it's one that for us to do design for regenerative cultures, we need to be thinking about what kind of pattern are we actually in. We're in a pattern where we exceeded overshoot a long time ago, and planetary collapse of the biosphere has already been occurring. Collapse of the human population has not yet happened, and a lot of people conflate those as the same thing. So they say, well, there may not be a collapse when there actually already has been in the biosphere. And then they may think, well, there may still be a human ingenuity to the cargo cult idea that humans can avoid their ecological reality. And somewhere in between the correcting of those assumptions is where you find a real path forward. But it's a sobering one, and it's there's still a lot of hope to be found within it, but it comes from places that aren't obvious before going through it.
Ari, you had a question earlier.
I feel like I have to take a moment after that, though. I guess the role of storytelling in all of this, which is my area of, you know, where my gift and where I feel like I can talk to my fellow storytellers, and I've been trying to activate them to engage in this generation of stories that at least show us better outcomes or show us different ways of life. I feel like, Joe, you're living a version of this, but I just want to get the brain trust here on like how I just don't see enough of this in the culture. And I feel like media, such a powerful way right now, at least to get this across. I suppose there's conversations like this one happening all the time now, but it's not reaching this elevated storytelling level, which so many people subscribe to, as we know now globally. I just want to see more stories that can activate these better outcomes for us. And I know I can inspire my people as storytellers to do so, but I'm just curious to hear from Joe and everyone how else we can do this, you know?
You know, this brings up something for me, a question I was wanting to ask, and you kind of perfectly segued into it. You know, one story that I'm seeing a lot of right now is the story about basic income and the conversation about that rising due to the popularity surge of Andrew Yang in the presidential election in the States. You know, related to Nev's question earlier about cities, I've been thinking about what a basic income would look like if implemented. And I've been thinking about what are the driving forces that bring people to concentrate in urban environments. And to me, a lot of it seems to be economically based. I can't really think of many other reasons. So I've been trying to extrapolate what is life like after a basic income. And that seems to be one thing that instantly has a dispersion effect from a basic income, is that, wait, if I get $1,000 a month, but it costs $2,000, $3,000 a month to live in, say, Vancouver, do I put that money toward, like, do I add it to my job and stay in Vancouver? Or do I go somewhere rural and live off of that money happily with my family and create a network out there? So I see this kind of, and already I noticed, because of what we talk about in Future Thinkers, people are constantly talking about starting their own permaculture community, that kind of thing. So I just want to say to Ari, like, that's one story or narrative I see that has so much implied underneath of it that people aren't really talking about. It just seems like, yeah, it'd be nice to have $1,000 in my pocket. So to extend that question to Joe, like, what do you think, what are your ideas about an implication or implications about basic income? You know.
Yeah, I'll start with basic income and then come back to Ari's question at a larger level, because it's really important. One of the problems with basic income, and we talked about this when I was working at The Rules several years ago, and Jason Hickel was actually the person who was really beautifully clarifying it, is that basic income has a disastrous framing and a liberating framing, and they don't get clarified enough. There's a way that there's sort of a... The stunted ethical development of an Ayn Rand type of libertarian that basically enables basic income to enslave people within an extractive system. Not because of basic income itself, but because of the narratives that we live out. Whereas, as you're describing, basic income, when understood in a different human development, like a properly holistic perspective of what it means to be a human, can be powerful and liberating and can free people to make different kinds of choices about their lives. And so I see basic income as something that is really powerful for redistributing or recirculating the wealth that's been created from extraction from the environment in ways that can empower more people to become regenerative, like going and doing permaculture farming would be an example. And so in that sense, if there's a narrative of people changing their lives in this way, then basic income becomes a recirculatory pattern to amplify it. Whereas if people just see themselves as cogs in the kind of consumer market machine living in cities, then all it's going to do is have a raising of cost of living. It'll re-equalize, you know, it'll re-standardize the cost of living to a higher level as people can extract more wealth and other things from the extractive mindset of the dominant paradigm. And so this relates to Ari's question in a really important way, which is what I found about storytelling when I was doing framing work on global warming and then also framing work on other topics was that one of our challenges that we have right now is that we don't have the ability to create stories for what hasn't happened yet. And that there's this profound experiential gap between the body's ability to understand and the stories from the past, they're not adapted or evolved for the context we're in. This creates a really powerful kind of culture hacking for good storytellers, which is sort of paradoxical because it seems like that would imply that we can't do storytelling. It's actually not true. What we can do instead is live out story creating, and story creating is storytelling. And so there's this really interesting way of seeing the role of storytellers to do something very powerful. And the powerful thing, which relates to the conversation we had during the previous Future Thinkers conversation about stages of psychosocial development for humans and how to get humans to higher functional levels of psychosocial development, which is that the intervention points where storytelling is transformative is the places in a person's life where their story is breaking down. And when their story is breaking down and doesn't make sense to them anymore, that's when they cross the gap of nihilism and do these other things we've talked about, this place of uncertainty, experimentation, exploration, lack of structure, confusion. In those places is where the storytelling is most potent. But it's a different kind of storytelling than having the story ahead of time. Like, it's more like, how do we create the story propagation tools to help people live stories together, right? Like that, which there's so much, I mean, Ari, you know this, there's so much known about how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like we're, I mean, the culture is really good at creating dystopian futures, you know, there's every example at the mainstream level of every shittier version of the world. So we've gotten good at that. You know, what used to be cautionary tales are now just everyday, you know, Hollywood's really good at this. And we don't have enough of the opposite, which wouldn't be utopia. I've been calling it protopian storytelling from Kevin Kelly's idea of, you know, slightly better worlds where we're solving some of our problems and maybe not creating new ones along the way, which ties very well with the work that you're doing. So I'm just wondering why, but you're explaining this piece of the puzzle to me, why we can't imagine, we have such a hard time imagining better versions of the future and such an easy time imagining worse. And therefore we have 600,000 dystopian films and TV shows. And I can find two or three examples in the last decade of maybe this kind of protopian storytelling, like the Wakanda and Black Panther or Arrival or, you know, things like that, at the highest level, talking at the kind of blockbuster kind of global level, because I do feel like that's one way to get a lot of people onto something.
You know, there. I've been to a bunch of discussions in different conferences in Europe, and I've noticed there's a really large interest in people wanting to make more utopian kind of sci-fi Netflix TV series. And I've been part of quite a number of brainstorms about this subject. And what I find most interesting is how little people are thinking about why the dystopian thing sells and why the utopian version doesn't, because of this,
that's right,
the natural hero's journey story arc where we need drama to maintain engagement in the story. And when people want to talk about the future or make a story about the future, they tend to make the future the story. It's like how we went through some sort of technological change or a singularity or whatever. So they end up painting themselves into a corner of needing to make the dystopia about what goes wrong in that society. But there's other examples that I really like. The movie Her, which we did a review about several years ago, is amazing because it makes the technology and the utopia an inconsequential backdrop to the real story, which is just human drama, except it's a drama between the main character and an artificial intelligence. But all of the tech is way in the background and mundane. And I thought that was a brilliant way to tell a utopian story. There's no external conflict.
There's only the drama in the story.
Yeah. Another thing that I was thinking about is what happens because of the psychological phenomenon of habituation. That once you get a certain level of stimulus, you have to have a proportionally greater amount of stimulus to have the same effect again. And habituation is why, you know, in behaviorism, they actually call it extinction of the stimulus. There's a stimulus that creates a response, but if you do the same stimulus, then the organism rehabituates to the new level of stimulation and then is much more difficult to stimulate. One of the more pernicious and chronic versions of this is the chronic use of inner pornography by men and their inability to have deep and emotionally significant romantic and physical relationships with women, where you can see how the habituation process is played out on a large scale, but it doesn't get talked about very much. Another version of this is the visual and auditory stimulation of moving pictures of kids watching cartoons and then kids watching action films. And you look at the how much we've accelerated the rate of changing perspectives. It used to be that you'd have the same camera view for like 30 seconds, and now within 5 seconds, it's changed 30 times. And all these ways that the people's attention is sort of manipulated by habituation. And I've seen this most powerfully when I have kids who spend a little time in nature versus kids who spend a lot of time in nature. Kids who spend a little time in nature are a little edgy, a little bothered, a little unsure what to do, and they are seeking the higher levels of stimulation that they're accustomed to in their high stimulation media environments. Whereas kids who didn't experience very much of it or have gone through a sort of deprogramming of habituation, they've been away from it long enough to sort of do a cultural detox to rediscover this capacity to be stimulated. To be stimulated by the changing hues and colors throughout the day, to be stimulated by the feeling of wind on their skin, to be stimulated by the sound of birds in the trees, and these other things. That this again sort of indicates the problems with cities. Another problem of cities, which is in cities, the ability to cultivate eco-literacy, the ability to be able to read and relate to the natural world, you know, the more than human world, is heavily stunted by the lack of direct access to ecosystems. And so there's this piece of it that I think is really interesting about what kinds of transitional supports can help people to re-immerse themselves in nature. And one of the challenges is that most ecosystems on Earth are no longer intact. Like, we spent 9 months in a tropical rainforest in Costa Rica, and our daughter would wake up in the morning naming the bird that she heard in the trees when she was 2 years old. Now we're in a nearly extinct tropical dry forest in a pretty barren landscape in the northern Andes, and our daughter wakes up to the sound of dogs barking and motorcycles going by, and even though we're in a small, quiet town up in the mountains, she doesn't hear the birds. She's not waking up to the ebb and flow of the insects that were in that intact ecosystem. And so I see this as a huge kind of relational and sensory deficit that, you know, that's what Wendell Berry called it, this sort of ecological autism. That is a factor in all of this that we couldn't break through with stories. If you've watched all of the all the superhero series of like X-Men or any of the other ones, you know, it's like those things are so stimulating visually, auditorily, emotionally, that the whole world seems black and white and dull in comparison. And so this is one of our challenges that storytelling doesn't cut it, but storytelling does. But it only does with fairly specialized sets of criteria being met, which are hard to reach. And mostly people won't reach unless they're really privileged. They actually have the money and capacity. Like, I have a US passport, so I can travel to someplace like Colombia. You know, I have a lot of privilege to enable me to do this. And so there are these interesting challenges about storytelling related to this, because you see that it's not only about the story, which of course I know that storytellers don't reduce it to that, but there's this whole like structural scaffolding of changing our life systems. And that's the story, is those experiences in many ways. But it's going to step away from movies and mainstream media and going to have a different kind of qualitative effect and quantitative effect. And it's a bit dissatisfying when we see the power of media. But it's there to grapple with as part of this.
Daniel Schmachtenberger, and also Peter Lindbergh in his article on the meme tribes, talks about supernormal stimuli, which is the name for these kinds of super stimulating experiences that hijack our evolutionary pathways, but they're in themselves not satisfying or not meaningful on a deep level, or they're disconnected from what we actually need. So, you know, sugar, porn, video games, things like that. And yeah, I think you bring up a really important point that storytelling, that the meta of storytelling is really important too. How is it told? In what context? How is it connected to everything else? Because if the story is like a candy, you know, it's a really powerful, potent story, but it doesn't reconnect us to our deeper nature and it doesn't fulfill us in some fundamental way, then, well, it's empty.
Yeah, at best it's a hook. At best it's kind of a hook or a reminder. But yeah, without this experiential aspect, I'm very aware that it's a very small piece of the puzzle, but I still feel like it's a very powerful hook if done right and can remind and get people and shake them out of the slumber.
Yeah, one nice example of like a specific example of a general phenomenon that I'll talk about in a moment is a movie like The Biggest Little Farm, where there are people who want to change.
I was just about to bring that up. Yeah, that's made such an impact.
Yeah, they're like, one of the ways that stories can be a hook is to create an early scaffolding step for people to radicalize their lives, where they see something that now feels doable and feels better, and they start to make changes. And then what's needed is the next scaffolding supports after that. And this is something I've been thinking about a lot with bioregional learning centers, this idea that we need to relocalize economies. And this is not a new idea, of course, but what's powerful now is we are on the verge of a special kind of disruption. Just we're about to have 100 million or more climate refugees in the next 15 or 20 years. And as we get an increasing number of people whose lives are disrupted by forced displacement, they cannot stay where they were before, that if there can be localized supports for people to transform their lives and have livelihoods, to bring them into these regenerative cultures, then that becomes a place where these storytelling tools show people how they can enter in. But then the infrastructure that still, I'd say it's being built, like ecosystem restoration camps and transition towns and Global Ecovillage Network and others are building some of the scaffolding for it, but there's more scaffolding needed. It's not there yet. And so what happens with a lot of people is they get to these crisis points of meaning, and they know that they need to make a change, but then they don't know how to change. And what they actually need is an apprenticeship, a special kind of apprenticeship. I'm experiencing this because of the way that I've been giving the workshop on planetary collapse, that people come to me for mentorship in an interesting way. It's a small number of people, but it's very powerful. Like when we announced that we were moving to Colombia about 4 months ago, we've been here for 3 months. So just before we came, I announced on Facebook that we were coming to Colombia. Sky in London sends me a note and says, my partner and I are thinking of leaving London. Could we come and help you with the project in Colombia? And I said, we haven't even arrived yet. We have no idea what's going to emerge. I wish I could say there was something to join, but there isn't. Stay tuned. Well, flash forward to about 3 weeks ago, and I get a Facebook message from this guy, and he says, I hope it's okay, but we just decided to come to Colombia and come to Barichara, and we found this volunteer opportunity on a little like camping agroforestry project just outside of town. And I don't want to interrupt, but could we maybe grab a coffee? And so just, you know, this person who, it was this couple really, but it was the guy in the couple who was ready to make the move, and his girlfriend was sort of ready to go along for the ride, was just their specific situation, these two people. what he was really looking for was the validation of being around someone that made him feel like he wasn't crazy. He's like, I've been doing sustainability work for 12 years in London, and I feel like everyone around me is insane, or I am. And I'm pretty convinced I'm not, but I just need to be around someone that gets this. And you see how that is a storytelling scaffold right there. And that apprenticeship and mentorship is going to be huge to become authentic role models available to be mentors for others. Even as like, I'm not a perfect person. I haven't figured it all out. My life is still a mess in a lot of ways, but I can still mentor this person because I've been doing this for a few years. So just like we were talking at the very beginning about the older kids helping the younger kids, here we are as just tall kids doing it. And so I think the storytelling aspect of this is very powerful because you start to think of how do we, like say the Humans of New York Facebook page, like remember that? Are there these ways of creating archetypal stories of real human beings that can become mentors for others, but then also have pathways to mentorship that may not exist right away, but gradually can. And I think that scaffolding process becomes an emergent co-creation among those people, which means it doesn't need to be rigid and centralized and all the things that we might critique about infrastructure. But the structural supports are mostly semantic. Like, how would I even know how to ask someone for help? Who would I look to as a role model, and how do I know that they're a role model? If I am a role model, how do I know that I'm a role model? Because I may not have that social feedback. So this is a place where storytelling can be really powerful. There's so much storytelling to do for this. And it's transformational change of people's lived narratives. They live a different story, a transformational change. And the storytelling is supports for that process. So I don't know if that resonates with you, Ari, or if it doesn't, but
absolutely, yes. That's a great... Thank you for guiding it there. Yeah. Thank you.
And intergenerational friendships are also something that comes to my mind as like another model that will probably be emerging more and more in the future. I don't know if like the general global population, I read somewhere that at some point it's just going to start declining, like for many reasons. And in that sense, I feel that like this intergenerational communication is just that's going to be like one integrative force that can actually push us forward, that can actually be like this cohesion and saving, that can actually save us in a way.
Yeah, I think about that discussion we had earlier today about self-stabilizing societies. And I was talking more about social norms when we started that part of the conversation. But another form of stabilizing is intergenerational role modeling of ethics and mentorship. So we sort of have the modern example of the high schooler who gets advice from the high school janitor, these sorts of relationships. But one thing you'll notice when you go to the countryside is that people above the age of 50, or maybe above the age of 60, are the people who still have endogenous knowledge, not indigenous necessarily, but endogenous, meaning they have knowledge of how to live in this place. And they might be the ones who know which leaf you take from the plant to make the paste to speak when you have a fever because their mother did it for them when they were a kid or something like this. And everywhere in the world, you'll find this kind of traditional knowledge. But there's a huge gap between people who entered the globalized economy and then the young people who are returning to seek it. Not all of them, but you just trickle by trickle, there's more and more. And they need to go to these elders to learn. And so in any given community, there might only be one or two, maybe five people. It might be a very small number of these older people. But these are people who have the knowledge and the disposition. They're the kind of people that interact well with young people, and the young people really do resonate with them. And this relationship is extremely important right now because we have this sort of cultural heirloom seed. Think what an heirloom seed is and how you protect seeds, put them in a seed bank. We need cultural heirloom seeds where the cultural knowledge that is about to be lost and in some places has been lost. The way to maintain it is by creating a bridge for those old people and young people to connect. The specific way that this is happening in the Escuela del Bosque here in Barichara is there's an old campesino man. I just was introduced to him yesterday. He's about 70 years old. He grew up in the countryside here, and he's been farming and doing agroforestry before it was called that, just as a person living here out on the landscape. And he's become friends with the family that started this forest school for kids. So it was yesterday that we went to work on our compost pile. We've gathered leaves from around the town and made a compost pile and starting this soil generation process for the food forest project. And this older man is there just offering to help. And I watched him as he walked over to a bush, pulled off a leaf from it, and explained to the four-year-old kids how they could use it when they got sick, because his mom used it on him when he got sick when he was a kid. And you could just see this beautiful exchange happening effortlessly by this old man basically finding joy in being around kids. And so these relationships are prevalent around us, and they're not celebrated around us, but they're fundamental to continuity of culture into the future. So this was just a topic that I think is really important, is that you probably just would nod your head and say, everything you said makes sense. I've heard this before, because it really is a thing that we know is important. But in this specific time in history, during exponential cultural change, this continuity needs to be treated with reverence. It is absolutely essential to our future, and we're very quickly losing it. So if we don't actively protect it, it will go away.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.